69 countries in how many years, Casey?
69 countries in now 14 years.
14 years. Wow. So that averages out to what per year?
I'm not sure.
Or is it very uneven how you travel, just
yes,
as the whim comes up?
It is. My original goal was 30 countries by the age of 30, and I ended up about 36 countries, and then I accelerated it then after that.
So how did this begin? How did you get this wanderlust?
As a little kid, I noticed that when everyone thought what they wanted to do when they grew up, they'd imagine themselves in an office, they'd imagine themselves as a doctor, firefighter, policeman. And I remember once upon a time when someone asked me, the first thing that came to mind was Indiana Jones.
Oh.
And I was like, you know, I don't really necessarily need the whip, but the idea of being in kind of academia, but at the same time traveling, as archaeology kind of disappeared in our modern era to a large extent, I had to kind of manifest it into a different idea, but I always knew I would do something different.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by areas that we never talked about in school. So I'd look at a map and I would see this giant country, because I grew up in the 80s. So by the late 80s, there's this giant red part of the map.
Yeah.
The Soviet Union. And I'd say, what is this place? And they'd say, that's the bad guys. And so I grew up on all this 80s cinema, Rocky IV, Red Dawn, and I thought this place is so crazy and different, but no one can tell me anything about it. And as a little kid, I remember watching the Berlin Wall come down. And of course, as a really little kid, they have tanks. They got guys with weird hats. There are accents. There's all kinds of things going on. Everyone knows that it's important. I see that it's important, but I don't understand why. And it wasn't until I got to read about these things and I thought the history, the literature, the politics, the economics of this entire area is completely unknown to me. And when anyone said, if I want to travel someday, I'm going to go to London. I'm going to go to Rome. I'm going to go to Paris. And I thought, maybe one day I'll go to those places too, but I want to go to Moscow. I want to go to Kazan. And I really want to go to those areas and see what that is like.
Yeah.
The first opportunity was through GRCC. They did a one-year study abroad program to Poland, to Krakow. And so I signed up immediately. And the program
was... Now, was this still in the Soviet years?
Nope.
No, afterwards.
Nope. This is 2003.
Okay.
And it was my first chance to really go abroad outside of, say, Mexico or Canada. And so I went for 6 weeks, and I stayed an additional 6 weeks after the group left. Mm. And as before smartphones, I had never really been on a train outside of maybe going to Chicago, you know, with parents. And so I got lost absolutely everywhere. I got lost in Hungary. I got lost in the Czech Republic, in Slovakia, everywhere. I missed trains. I got lost everywhere. But at the same time, it was this experience that I knew there was no going back.
Now, in my own travels, I've always found that the misadventures, the times you get lost, the time the car breaks down or you miss your train or whatever, end up being your best travel stories. How did that work out for you?
Well, I don't know that I was familiar with the concept in my early 20s. It wasn't until I was familiar with the word serendipity, but I didn't have an actual encounter with the phenomenon until missing these trains and getting lost in some of these places, because I know it's cliche, but as you get lost in the world, you occasionally find yourself.
Yes.
And so being absolutely lost in Prague, being absolutely lost in Budapest, and going into a pub and striking up a conversation with the person next to you and saying, I have no idea where I am. And this person looking over with a curious glance and saying, where are you from? You say, I'm from Michigan, United States. What are you doing here? And an hour later, they draw you a map. They invite you to dinner. And all of a sudden, you make these connections that I think, especially for our modern era, we're grasping always for a measure of authenticity that oftentimes isn't there.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, these interactions become the most authentic. Maybe because there's a slight sense of urgency, or there's a mixture of fear, of hope, of optimism, of all these things. And it comes together in this incredible mixture.
Yeah.
That is, it's almost intoxicating. And there's no going back after that. Because when you come back after 3 months in Eastern Europe and someone says, oh, yeah, I'm really excited to go on vacation. We're going on a cruise. And you say, oh, with bunch of people from the Midwestern United States that look like you, talk like you. You guys are going to eat at Jimmy Buffett's cheeseburger, something about paradise, and have a good time going to beach resorts that are designed
and stay at the Holiday Inns or whatever
tourists.
The heck it is.
Yeah. I said, no, I never wanted that. I wanted something different, but I wanted something real. Yeah. I always wanted
that's
to feel.
Traveling in a bubble. I'm like you. I've never wanted to be in a tour group. Although back in the Soviet years, I was over there, and you couldn't break out of that bubble. You had to be in a tour group. Did you ever make it over there during those years, or no?
No, because by the time the Soviet Union fell, I was still under 10. And I remember the first time getting to Russia, because Russia was a large part of the goal, mm-hmm. but the restrictive visa process and the politics and these things. Yeah. The first time I end up in Russia is with a study abroad through Grand Valley State University. And I go in 2005. And when you get outside of St. Petersburg and Moscow, mm-hmm. oftentimes you stay in the in-tourist yes. hotels, which was yes. that agency. And they are still what I will call high Soviet drab. Everything in the room is orange, right? Everything yes. just doesn't quite fit. But at the same time, you think, this is authentic as it gets.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't made for consumers in mind at all. Yeah. And you get to see some of this socialist, realist, impressionist style, this architecture style, that it's just so much different than what we see.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
I'm immediately drawn to it and find it fascinating.
Now, as you travel, you've just described how people can be friendly if you're lost and let them know. They'll help you out and even invite you over for dinner. Has that affected your view of humankind, having traveled all these places? Does it make you an optimist?
Absolutely. And I think the other key ingredient to that is there are so many places that people say, oh, that's not so nice. And my most recent example was I was really excited to go to South Africa. And I found a crazy cheap flight flying into Johannesburg. And people said, oh, well, you don't want to stay in Johannesburg. You know, you just use that as a dropping off point and you get out of there. And I would say, well,
because it's dangerous or?
And so when I asked why, they would say, oh, well, it's not very nice. It's ugly. It's dangerous. And you could almost sense a kind of unsavory undertone to that element. And so I said, you know, you want to go to Cape Town, the beaches, and all this is very nice. And as I listened to people, I realized that they had said the same things about Detroit my entire life. And Detroit happens to be one of my favorite cities in the entire world. And so when I got to Johannesburg, I doubled my amount of time there. I was only supposed to stay there 3 days. I stayed 6 days. I met amazing people. I went to amazing and just thrilling tiny markets. I went to farmers markets. I went to pop-up art galleries. And to see all the things that people were doing there blew my mind. And now Johannesburg is one of my favorite places as well.
Well, there you go. You just said, and I saw in some of your pictures on your blog called The Gypsy Professor, and you've got wonderful pictures.
Thank you.
A few times you're wearing this shirt. Well, now you have 616 on your shirt as you're sitting here in the studio, but Detroit is on your shirt. And you just said it's your favorite city. After seeing so many different, incredible cities, what is it about Detroit? Is it because it's home or something else?
No, because I think one of the most interesting things about Michigan is you can drive for 10 hours and still be in the same state, but it doesn't feel like the same state.
True.
So I grew up in Grand Rapids. You know, for those of us familiar with the area, it's conservative. The way it was founded, especially in around Holland and these other places, the west side of the state is a community of the covenant. So people came there to make a more pious version of community and whatnot, whereas Detroit was a community of accretion. You know, it came together from trade. It came together from the fur trade and economics and French, you know, outposts and whatnot. When I went to Detroit as a kid, we'd go for a sports game. We'd get off the expressway, go to the arena, run back to the car, and leave. Now, this is the biggest city in the state. Why don't we ever spend time here? And I started exploring Detroit in earnest in my probably late 20s. So I started really about 6 or 7 years ago. And when someone had told me that Detroit had 88,000 abandoned buildings, I wallowed in it. They call it ruin porn. And I went to see the hulks of industry. And then I had to read everything about Detroit. And it wasn't until the last year. This is my first year teaching the history of Michigan. As a course at GRCC, and getting into the history of Detroit, you realize that this is one of the most important cities in the United States. This is the arsenal of democracy. This, in the 1960s, was seen as the most futuristic city in America. And the way all these things come together, this Isabella Wilkerson Her groundbreaking book, The Warmth of Other Suns. This is the pinnacle of the Great Migration. This is where credit is invented. This is where the automobile is invented, the paved road, the traffic light. What you have in the bones of that city is the American dream. It was the idea of upward mobility. And I can't separate this grand scheme, this huge idea of the American dream from Detroit. Detroit symbolizes that, in my opinion, more than any other place. And now getting to Detroit, getting back there and looking through the parts of the ruins, but parts of the rebirth, Detroit doesn't look like anywhere else. What I'm increasingly worried about in the United States is, as I go to different cities, it's the increased homogenization. Right? Oh, it's a civilian walkway. It's a high glass tower. It's a gastropub. It's gentrification done over and over in the same versions. Yeah. And even in the city of Grand Rapids, we noticed that the marketing firms all said, okay, if you have a new bar, pick a color and pick an animal. Steel cat, blue dog. I mean, they rolled them out, black heron. They rolled them out almost like pre-packaged versions of Applebee's, but with a local flair. And okay, parts of that is cool. But other parts of it, I want something real, and Detroit is as real as it gets.
Mm. I've always thought that in traveling, you come back not only a different person, but you see home a different way. On that vein of what we've just been talking about, how has all this travel around the world changed how you see home?
I think initially it opened my mind to how people the world over view our culture.
I'm curious about that, too.
And I was in Haiti recently, and Haiti is one of the top 20 poorest countries in the world. It's in the 20 poorest countries of the world. And this is right before the president's very unfortunate remarks about Haiti. And I was in a hotel in Port-au-Prince, and what happened to be on the television but Man versus Food? Man versus Food is a television show in which a guy travels around the United States to take food challenges. So he finds pubs, bars that have, you know, 7 pounds of nachos with X amount of cheese, beef, you know, something. And he literally eats it in a physical contest to see if he can ingest this much food without physically submitting. And as I'm watching this, it comes to light that 2/3 of the Haitian population survives on less than $2.20 a day. I'm like, this is what they see. This is their version of America, is a sweaty, large man, you know, eating his 15th hot dog while people cheer him on to hope that he can get to 20 or 30 or something similar. And I thought, this is so crazy because this show is broadcast to parts of rural China. I mean, it's broadcast all over the world. And this is what people see as the pinnacle of American culture. This is the so-called leadership of the world. And taking that into consideration, I thought, oh, wow. There's so many elements of our culture, I think, that we've become normalized to. Like, we don't realize how extreme those things can be.
Yeah.
And in encountering people from so many different places, the way they view the United States, because some of those Haitians at the same time see the United States as this beacon of light, as this beacon of hope, and everything good in the world is wrapped in the stars and stripes. And I see that optimism, and it makes me smile. I feel warm. Right. But it also at the same time makes me feel incredibly thankful to have had those opportunities to recognize my privilege and to do those things as well.
Have you seen that perspective change over the years that you've been traveling?
Yes. The first time I was in Ireland was 2004. And I went to the bathroom and ended up standing shoulder to shoulder with an Irish guy who asked me what I thought about John Kerry. And I said, he seems like an okay guy. I haven't seen much of the primaries. And so I looked at him and said, what do you think about Tony Blair? And we both just laughed and went back to the pub. You know, it was a matter of politics. But United States, American politics, people are familiar with this all over the world. And they don't expect Americans necessarily to be familiar with their politics at the same time. But you see the distress. In our last election cycle, people asked me constantly, like, what is happening in your country? Who is going to win this election? Because they felt that it mattered to their personal life. At the same time, I was in Vietnam for the first time, one of my favorite countries of all time as well. And I met a friend who told me that we could find the best bún cha in Hanoi. And I end up on the back of a moped, which was a very funny sight. But we end up at this restaurant. We have this amazing bún cha. And I find out that President Obama is coming the next week. And every Vietnamese person I talked to almost cried at the idea of seeing the United States president. When Obama arrives, Anthony Bourdain, who's a personal hero of mine, is also in Vietnam, and they go for Bun Cha at the same restaurant. I can never go back to that restaurant because there's a line every day.
Still.
Yeah, and you can order the Obama. It's Bun Cha, spring rolls, and a tiger beer.
Oh, wow.
The table that they sat at is like it's been made into a shrine.
Roped off.
In the restaurant. Yeah.
Really?
It's got a plastic cage around it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so I had the best Bun Cha of my life, but now I can kind of remark that I'll never have it again.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Is it changed today?
It's drastically changed. I think in our current political situation, the definite turn towards more of a nationalist bend, this turn inward, this America first kind of program, if you want to call it that, has really dismayed so many people on an international spectrum because they don't understand. When people talk to me, they say, why is this happening? And for me, it draws into a much larger conversation of trying to explain coal miners, technology, disintegrating middle class ideology, and some of these other things. So it's become a very tenuous conversation, but at the same time illuminating because it's led to hours of conversation of comparing nationalist politics even abroad. And oftentimes over a meal or over beverages of some variety.
Fascinating. So your background is, well, you've got a couple of jobs that you do. You're a professor, yes?
Yep.
History?
This is my eighth year.
Okay. And you also work in a family business?
Mm-hmm. It's Tonton Lumber Company.
Yeah.
I've been there for 15 years.
Okay. And then the traveling. So I wondered about how you work in the time, but I wonder if our listeners might also be thinking, 69 countries in so many years, how do you afford this?
So I get asked this all the time, and I will get Facebook messages, I will get random messages, I'll get emails from people that I have not talked to since 10th grade, and they'll say, hey, love your pictures, tell me exactly how you do this. And I don't have a very straightforward answer. When someone says, show me how to do it, it's like sitting someone down saying, show me calculus. So I spend probably about 45 minutes a day on airfare, on ideas, on building itineraries. And when I say that if you want it, you can make it happen.
Reading your blog, I kind of get the impression that it's almost like you watch airfares like the stock market.
It's the same.
Yeah. It drops, it's like, okay, that's comfortable.
And that's,
go for it.
At the same time, that's also how I travel. So someone says, where are you going next? And I say, I don't know yet. I have a short list. Everyone has a short list, right?
Places
they'd love to go. But if something, I say, pops, when it pops, it's time to go.
Yeah.
And so the great example is this morning, looking at things before I left, there are incredibly cheap flights to London. I've been to London. I didn't particularly care for it. But to go to London for a weekend for under $300, that could be fun.
Yeah.
And so I might end up doing that. On the same note, I make sacrifices in order to do that because I am not married. I don't have kids. I've graduated now. I have a houseplant. I don't have pets.
Congratulations, Casey.
Hey, I'm getting there. Maybe another 10 years, I can have a cat or something similar. But this is something I always wanted to do. And when people say, what? It's a younger kind of verbiage. They'll say, what is your life? I'll say, everything I ever wanted it to be because that's what I thought the point was.
Yeah.
And I was never doing something because I felt I was supposed to or anything else like that. This has been an organic upswell for me. People ask me, what do you want to do when you get older? I want to see the world. And if I can make it happen, I will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the interesting things, too, as you read your blog, as we've talked before, you used to travel with a companion, and then at some point you started traveling solo.
Yeah. So like anyone else, I think that you have a choice in almost every aspect of life. I think you can rely on one of two things, either fear or hope. And for a long time, the idea of traveling alone, because those 6 weeks after my group left that first time in Poland, I got lost everywhere. And so I thought, parts of it were amazing, parts of it weren't. Sitting in a train station in Wrocław, Poland for 6 hours, with the same announcement going over in Polish that I can't understand. But then after that, I thought, if I go with somebody else, it's an easy way to share costs. It's an easy way to do this, of course, and whatnot. And it came down to, having this itinerary, having everything set up with a friend, and having them pull out at the last possible second. And as I wrote about in my post, The Glory of Solo Travel, I thought, okay, I'm not going to go. This is canceled. I was decimated. I needed this. I had come out of a giant breakup. I didn't know necessarily what I was doing. There was a lot of mid-20s angst, I guess, maybe if you want to call it that. And so at the last minute, I said, you know, wait a minute. For lack of a better term, screw it. I'm going.
Yeah.
No matter what. And I booked the flight, and I ended up in Lithuania. Even though originally I was supposed to be in the Balkans. I mean, I was supposed to go with someone else, and I was supposed to go to one group of countries, and I ended up going by myself and landing in Lithuania without really an idea of what exactly I was going to do. And then I bought bus tickets into Latvia, and then I bought bus tickets into Estonia, and I loved every single bit of it, and I never looked back. And now 95% is solo.
What did you eat and drink in Latvia?
You know, I don't remember the names, and I'd probably slaughter the pronunciations, but oftentimes as I'm walking, there's still a measure of serendipity because I love walking the city, and so I end up in...
Especially the old part of Riga. Gorgeous.
And so I was only in Riga, so I can't say I did all of Latvia, of course. I was in Riga for 3 days, and so every time I walk by, if it looked like there were non-tourists there and it looks like it's full of locals...
There you go.
That's where I sat down. Oftentimes... They speak enough English, I can point at enough things and kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
And whatever comes out, I'm eating it regardless.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things as well. I think food, they used to call it history through the stomach, right? And you taste a culture, you breathe it in, and you see it. And I have an idea that whatever you're served, you have to try it, especially if people invite you to a lunch or dinner. That's why I struggle when people say, oh, well, I would travel, but, you know, I need a gluten-free diet and, you know, these other things. And I say, well, that's okay at home because we have that luxury, right? I think that's almost the epitome of privilege. When you end up in Southeast Asia and that first bowl of whatever it is that's served, but it's steaming, there's noodles, and there's what we might call questionable protein options, you eat it.
Yeah,
and you say thank you and you enjoy it.
Well, food is a big part of all of your journeys.
It most definitely is.
Yeah. And I think probably that why mamas are always feeding their babies, whether they want to or not. You know, there's something bonding. There's some connection that we make human to human. It's a big part of how we socialize with each other. It's a way that we bond. And as you said, it's a way to learn something about the culture. What is it that sustains them? So talk about some of the food that you've eaten.
I think one of the more extreme was being in Vietnam and hanging out with locals and them saying, okay, do you want to eat tourist food or do you want to try real food? And when you're asked that in Southeast Asia, for most places, it's almost like you buckle up and let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I always have an open mind for this stuff. And so we go, and it's always from a tiny blue plastic table with a little footstool that I don't fit on very well, but I give it the best try that I can. And you're hunched over this bowl, and it's going to come out with so many different flavors. I mean, the flavor profiles in the Midwestern United States are usually referred to kind of as bland at best. But these flavor profiles, the aroma, the taste, everything is just, it's like a new discovery with every bite. And that first, one of those first times, the dish comes out and they're like, try it first. And they're smiling and I'm eating it and it's very rubbery. And they eventually tell me that it's pig uterus.
Okay.
And I thought, this isn't the best, but you know what? I'm going to get through it. And so after that, then came boiled snails from like a street food vendor. They cook it almost on the curb. After that, chicken feet was in there. I wasn't a big fan of chicken feet. The snails are really good, though. And then a lot of local words that I can probably not quite pronounce.
Yeah.
But they thought it was the coolest thing ever that I would try it regardless of what it was.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the vast majority of it. And you see some of those pictures. They're on the blog. They've been on the Facebook page where I sit down at a restaurant and people look for a minute. People turn because I'm the only non-local in there.
Mm.
And they wait for a minute. And whatever comes out, there's kind of that pensive moment where people kind of look up from their food, glance over like, is he going to eat it? And I eat it and smile, and all of a sudden, the mood changes, and eventually someone comes over with a beer.
Yeah.
And they say, hey, you know, how are you? Where are you from? What are you doing here? And I think so many of my interactions have started in a similar way.
Over a bowl or a plate of something.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone to a lot of places, as you said, off the beaten path seems to be your biggest pull. One of the places you've gone to is Chernobyl, and more than once, I believe.
Twice,
yeah. I was reading on your blog about the dogs.
Yeah.
So talk about this place.
So Chernobyl long captivated my imagination. The Chernobyl disaster happens in 1986, and so I'm very young. But as I understand this idea, it enters in this kind of sci-fi, almost fantasy mindset of what could happen with that amount of radiation. I mean, growing up again in the 80s, all the comic books, from The Incredible Hulk to Spider-Man, this is all radiation.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm very fascinated by this concept of society organized in such a different way. And so it becomes a Soviet Pompeii. The election banners are still up. The buses are still there. And what happens when a city of over 100,000 people just has to empty over the course of a weekend?
Yeah.
And then it's left. And so I read kind of early on, I thought, God, one day when I travel, I'd really like to go to Ukraine. Ukraine seems, it occupies a huge part for Russian history. And my background, I have a degree in Russian history and Slavic studies. So getting to Ukraine, it was the birthplace of Kievan Rus. And so the first time I get to Ukraine, I know that my major goal is to go to Chernobyl. And I work with this amazing tour company because Ukraine, like so many other places, works best if you have what I call a fixer. So someone on the ground that can facilitate these things. And I meet this guy who organizes everything and sets it up. Now, people that wander into the zone are affectionately referred to as stalkers. And having trekked through numerous abandoned sites throughout Detroit, parts of the Midwest, parts of Europe, this is the ultimate stalker experience. Mm. And so getting there the first time, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And seeing the crippled reactor, taking in the history, seeing the giant catfish in that cooling channel that have been glow-in-the-dark now for quite a while, and absorbing kind of the tragedy that was this place, because Chernobyl was a new city. This reactor was built. Soviet society, you had to have, phenomenal grades, and you had to be someone to be selected to move there because the apartments were new, the schools were new, the shops were new. This was a big deal in the Soviet Union. So something like 65% of the population or something similar were under the age of 25. I mean, this was young families building their dreams there, and then it came to an end one day.
Yeah.
Very suddenly, right? It was a great book. I usually read before bed, but you can't read this one before bed, called Voices of Chernobyl.
Mm.
And she's a Belarusian writer. And I think everyone should read it and take a minute to think about what happened there. But going through those abandoned buildings, the stadiums, the furniture shops, the restaurants, I mean, seeing the old rusty sickle and hammer above these things, seeing the decapitated, crumbled Lenin statues, these other things. I mean, you get to see kind of what it was like. And the aura there, the feeling there is like nowhere else.
And the dogs kind of brought it home to me when I was reading the blog and saw the picture of these wonderful puppies, and radiation in their fur, that kind of thing. But, when a town shuts down so suddenly, those beloved pets, you can't take them with you. What happens to the animals? That kind of really brought it home.
Because they were so radioactive, unfortunately, they sent teams of cleaners through the city to essentially take the animals out of the equation.
Mm.
But they didn't get all of them.
Yeah.
Some of them hide. And at this point, Chernobyl is Europe's largest nature preserve. Because as they've watched this happen, the house mouse is gone, but the field mouse has returned.
Mm.
There's moose now in the zone. There are packs of wolves. There are bear. All of a sudden, this is a giant staked out place where humans can't taint it beyond what they've already done.
Yeah.
And what they've noticed is certain of these species, especially the mouse, they've adopted part of that radioactivity into their, they're altered. It's an altered species. It's unique to Chernobyl. They're a little bit bigger.
Mm.
And there are other facets that they've been changed from this radioactive fallout.
Wow, it's like a sci-fi story
or something.
Yeah.
It is. And so I had to go back a second time because the first time I went through, it almost came out as a blur. And it's one of those things that you're going to go there usually all day. You can stay right outside the zone and do a multi-day tour if you want. I did a full day and then came back to Kiev. And it's like, people are like, oh, we should go out for beers. We should do this. And I thought, no. I'm exhausted, not physically, but mentally and everything else for the day. And the pictures came out amazing. But then I traveled the next time with a digital SLR and had more of a focus on a few particular things.
Promise me you're going to put together a coffee table book of photos, because they are remarkable, and some of the Chernobyl shots are some of the most remarkable, I think. But lots of beautiful photos.
I hope to.
Yeah, so we'll have that link on our website, too. Best travel advice, if somebody wants to do something like you're in the process of doing, what lessons can you share?
I have always, probably in the last 5 years, I've realized that either A, you find a reason to go, or you'll find a dozen excuses not to. And I've talked to so many people that, you know, they really wanted to go to London for the Olympics. They really wanted to go to this particular thing. And they were going to, and then 10 years later, they've got young kids, they've got this, they've got, credit card debt, they've got a mortgage to worry about, they have to fix the lawnmower. There's always going to be 1,000 reasons not to.
Yeah, yeah.
Embrace the reason to do it and go. Find a reason to go, because I think travel is the one purchase that will almost always make you richer.
I have to agree with you on that.
Someone countered that once and said, outside of from Apple stock. And I said, well, it depends what price you buy it.
Is it possible for you to choose a best travel story? Because now you've got, your life is packed with them.
Well, one of my favorites was last year. I've spent New Year's now. And again, the sacrifices to make it happen. I am gone usually over Thanksgiving. I am gone over Christmas. I'm gone over New Year's. And people say, well, I can never do that.
Those are your vacation times.
That's fine. Yeah. And I said, you know, you stay home. I will travel in the off season. And I will get people say, oh, well, you went to Ireland in December. Well, I would never do that. And I said, well, you stayed on the couch. I would never do that. If you want to do it, you'll make the sacrifice to do it, or you won't.
Yeah.
And this last December, I flew into Ireland. I ended up going to Portugal, winding through Spain, through Malaga. And I ended up crossing two countries off my list to make it closer to every country in Europe, which I succeeded later this summer. But it was going to Romania and Bulgaria. So it came down to it. I did Christmas in the south of Spain. And then where am I going to spend New Year's? And I thought, I've been in Western Europe too long. I need the East. And so I flew to Bucharest. And in Bucharest, I stayed in the old town. And it's New Year's. And the way Eastern Europe works is everyone reserves tables. Well, I'm by myself, so I don't reserve a table, so I can sit at the bar.
Yeah.
I sit at this bar in the old town of Bucharest, Romania. I'm having a conversation with the bartender. I'm drinking a Carlsberg. It's my second beer. A couple sits next to me, and in a very thick, pronounced accent, someone says, excuse me, do you speak English? And I said, yes. And they said, oh, nice. No, very good. Do you know where the fireworks will be? And I said, I've only been here for 12 hours. And they said, oh, where are you from? And I said, United States. And now both of them turned to me and said, where in the United States? And I said, Michigan. And her eyes glow wide for a second. And I said, where are you from? They're from Belgrade, Serbia. And I said, oh, I've been to Beograd. You know, it's a great city. And I'm talking about the Balkans. And they said, where in Michigan? And I looked at them for a moment with a cursory glance. And I said, Grand Rapids. And I thought they would both fall out of their chair. She was an exchange student to Forest Hills Northern. She asked me, do you know Forest Hills Northern High School? And I said, yes, I know Forest Hills Northern.
Yeah.
And so she lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 2 years and then went to GRCC.
See, it is a small world.
She went to GRCC for a year. And I said, that's where I work. And we have this moment over beverages. And we chat. We ended up hanging out the entire next day. And they went back to Serbia. And I went to Bulgaria. We're friends on Facebook. We chat all the time, and I have an open invite to return back to Belgrade because I'd been there 3 or 4 times. But now I have to, and talk to this person that went to the same high school my father did.
Amazing.
And how, I mean, for happenstance, I just think this was meant.
Yeah.
This was meant to happen. This blows my mind.
Well, that's yet another benefit of these worldwide travels. You have friends everywhere.
I do.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger?
I have never felt like I was in bodily, like threat of bodily harm. But at the same time, I have watched situations where, you know, if I don't know a city, I'm not getting blind drunk on a random night by myself with valuables on me. And I've taken these precautions over the years. You know, my wallet's not in my back pocket. I don't have a fanny pack or any of these other things. I'm not flashing lots of currency, generally for the most part. I think there's something called being situationally aware. And if people say, hey, that's the really tough part of a city, if locals tell me that, then I might go watch, see it during the day if there's something to see there, but I don't seek trouble out.
Sure.
And I notice that oftentimes the precursor to something bad happening, you have a much higher chance of being robbed in London, Barcelona, Paris, than you do anywhere in these dangerous places in Eastern Europe. Mm. I mean, the crime rates for travelers is very low. If it does happen, someone steals your camera because it's hanging loosely around your neck and you're not paying attention, or they steal your bag because you left it in a bench somewhere.
So what's on your bucket list, Casey? Where, you know, 69 down, what?
So in 69 was not intentional. I was supposed to cross from Haiti to the Dominican and I just ran out of time. Mm-hmm. It was going to be, I could take a bus, step over the border, and then turn around, and I said, no.
Oh, that's cheating.
It is. And so I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. This last trip over spring break, so 2 weeks ago, I took a retired friend that retired from GRPS and his daughter. We went across northern France to Normandy and through the World War I battle sites down to Mont-Saint-Michel, across through Champagne country, and then up through Bruges, Belgium. And it was a wonderful time. It was like traveling with a family, you know, that it was a very unique experience. I loved every bit of it. But I had been to all those places before. And so now, the first week of May, I leave for South America.
Ah.
And I've been to every country in Europe now, depending how you count them. I've not been to Cyprus. So if you count Cyprus, I have not.
Okay.
But in case that you don't, then I have. So I've done a long stretch through Southeast Asia this December, and I've been in and out of Asia a few times over the last year or so. My focus has really turned towards Central and South America, and I'd like to see a lot more of Africa. So I fly to Colombia, I'm hoping into Ecuador and maybe Peru on this run, and then we'll be more focused on South America and Africa.
What about places like Antarctica and Iceland?
I've been to Iceland.
Okay.
Iceland's really cool, but I would very much like to go back to Iceland and do a longer road trip, because it's one of the only places you can see volcanoes, glaciers, and everything in one trek.
Yeah.
And I notice now that Iceland's becoming increasingly popular.
It is.
And so many people are going that the locals are getting a bit upset because they are historically incredibly hospitable. There's only 300,000 some people that live in Iceland. They have some of the highest rates of, I think something like 8% of the population plays a musical instrument or is in a band that currently performs. I mean, they have the highest per capita of authors and this other stuff. It's an incredible little place.
Yeah.
Even for Iceland Air, all their planes are named after figures of their mythology. They diverted an expressway once because it was going to go through an area where they said, well, there aren't really fairies there, but according to all the legends, that's where fairies would be. And we don't want to, you know, mess the cosmic karma, so we're going to have to divert this road. And I thought, that's just great. I would like to do a longer road trip there before so many tourists go that it changes irrevocably. Antarctica, I would like to see it, to step on it, to say, hey, I've been to this continent.
Yeah, that's exotic.
Yeah, see a few penguins. I was close. I was all the way at the tip. I was on the Cape of Good Hope. In South Africa. That's the closest I've been yet.
The happiest place?
Happiest place. That's a tricky one. Probably, you know, the happiest place indexes that they rate every year, it's always Finland, Sweden.
Yeah, it's around
Denmark,
that area.
Right?
Yeah.
And Denmark, I think they're the happiest because their leading exports are Lego and bacon. You can't have a bad time if that's what you're exporting.
Eat bacon and play with Legos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and for places like Norway, you know, they decided that 6 weeks of paid vacations where you start and you work 35 hours a week. And I think that does a lot to restore balance. But for happiest people, I would almost say Thailand. The people seem so incredibly happy, smiling and nice. There are a lot of areas probably in the South Pacific that I have not been that seem very happy as well. The Scandinavian countries, I think that in like deep down, they're very happy, but they have kind of a cold demeanor until you get to know them.
Reserved, I think. Yeah,
much like Slavic people.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for stopping by between all these journeys.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, I have a few weeks local before I leave again, so.